Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. We're back for another quick behind-the-scenes peek into what's gone into this week's issue. I'm the title staff writer, Jesse Billington, and this week I'm joined by editor David Simister, features editor Chris Hope, and content editor James Peen. Gentlemen, how are we?
Yeah, it's good to actually see some sunshine for a change and some classic cars actually being out, being enjoyed. I mean, over the past few days, I've seen all sorts. I've seen a Citroen 2CV. I've seen Austin 7s being out enjoyed. It's just nice to actually see people getting their cars out of the garage and enjoying them.
Well, I can't spoil what we were doing because it's a feature that's coming up. But we were driving convertibles in the sun yesterday, weren't we, Jesse? So yeah. My head feels quite tender at the moment. I don't know if it's looking too red at the sort of thing. So I did not pack any sun cream, which was a very much mistake on my part. So
yeah, I think the glare off the tarmac through the day when we're doing the shoot, I definitely sort of got in and noticed like my cheeks were feeling a bit sort of sun kissed by the end of it. Yeah, should have put some SPF on in the morning. James, how are things down at your end of the country?
Oh, really good. Nice and sunny. Got a weekend of car working planned. So looking forward to getting out and not getting wet.
Yeah, nice chance to finally do some work in the dry. I've got the same plans. Nearly got the Jimny finished. We've got a rear wheel cylinder fitted. Bled the brakes out last night. I've just got to adjust the handbrake and then bleed out the fronts. And we should be ready to resubmit for an MOT. And I finally had all the parts, most of the parts arrive for the midget as well. So I can start building up the engine on that front. Had Rimmer Brothers sort out some com rods for me yesterday. I've just got to sort out all the bits and pieces for sort of new springs and valves. But again, I can do all the bottom end to start with and figure out where I go from there. Will it be ready for drive it day? It's
I was going to say, are you admitting defeat at this point? Is it going to be the Jimny for drive it day?
I don't want to admit defeat just yet. It might get to like the 25th and I finally admit defeat, but I've got hope. I've got still hope, living in hope at this point, I think is the best way of saying it. That or I'm simply a river in Egypt. I am in denial, but oh well. David, how are things on your classic side?
Yeah, looking good. I mean, again, I think with me, the challenge is not so much whether I can take my MX-5 out for drive days, whether or not I want to squeeze a huge stepladder into the car, which I have managed once before. It's a difficult ask, but it's not impossible. It just means that I will not be taking anyone with me, because the great thing with the MX-5, of course, is a two-seater sports car, and I can't carry a stepladder and a passenger at the same time. So depends on what I want, company or a great driver on the lake.
It is worth pointing out a stepladder is not a prerequisite to drive it day. It's simple that David likes to get some nice high up photography of lots of cars at venues that he goes and attends, isn't it? So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you don't have to, if you are out enjoying your classic car and drive it day, you don't have to go to B&Q and buy a stepladder, just to point that out.
Would it not be simpler at this point to buy like a little monopod to put your camera on, or maybe like a small drone? Just thinking out loud, it could be.
Well, I have got my tripods, which I use again to get the height that I need for those really lovely shots that you see in Classic Car Weekly. But I've always thought about buying a drone, but the thing I'm always terrified of is if it suddenly cuts out in midair and then lands on someone's Series 1E type and crushes a bonnet that's worth about £15,000. That's the sort of thing that keeps me awake at night.
I suppose then you buy a small fishing net to sort of catch it in as it sort of plummets out of the sky as the battery fails.
I just go out around car shows and just pre-apply a fishing net over a huge net over the top of every show. It's getting more complicated by the minute.
Yeah, maybe we'll just stick with the ladder. Anyway, that's what's going on in our classics world at the moment. We'll jump into this week's issue and we'll start as we usually do with the news. And there's new hope for modern classics. We've seen sort of a wave of new enthusiasts and new tech coming to save younger classic cars on the scene.
Yeah, it's really interesting this. So this was something that was it was talked about quite extensively at the restoration show at the NEC, and that certainly the vibe I was getting, there was quite a buzz around modern classics, particularly sort of late 80s, 90s cars. We saw that in the on-site show conducted by Classic Car Auctions. There were some really big prizes. I mean, the one that struck me was there was a Fiat Uno Turbo that went for just over 30 grand, which Yeah, it's a hot hatch. It's absolutely an absolutely amazing restoration, but it's just in my head, 30 grand and Fiat Uno do not belong in the same universe, let alone the same sentence. So it just shows you how much appetite there is for these cars. And the great thing is, because of the appetite for these cars, there's kind of the opposite of a vicious circle going on, a positive circle where the appetite is dry, is encouraging specialists to set up to cater for these restorations. And in turn, the fact that people can restore these cars then drives the demand again. So it's there's actually a really, positive buzz, which I think is a good thing, because it means that these fabulous cars, things like, what happens with an Escort RS Turbo also helps keep a pop plus on the road as well.
James, obviously you sort of covered a bit of the news section when we're putting this together. What are the bits that sort of jumped out for you?
I just think it's quite a positive outlook for modern classics at the moment. Everybody I've spoken to seems to think that it's like that is the future. Because if you think about it, all the classics that we tend to sort of focus on, the skills for those are dying out because the people who are working on them are getting older and older. Whereas the next generation who will be coming through to look after the next generation classics, they're already working on them. So I think, that in itself is going to be a positive for us.
Yeah, it's that sort of the skills, the knowledge of dealing with more electrical componentry, ECUs, and the style of technology that these younger classics bring with them. We're seeing people that are familiar with that moving into sort of the world of repair and fixing them and keeping them alive.
Yeah,
I find it
absolutely.
interesting. Sorry, James.
Go, 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 Chris.
I mean, all I was going to say was there's been sort of, and I think perhaps we as working in with the media are perhaps a little bit guilty of it as well. This assumption that just because cars are becoming more complicated, that's going to potentially create roadblocks sort of thing. So, I mean, reading the article, I think James, you spoke with Mike Brewer sort of thing, and he himself sort of admitted, he's never come across any car that isn't fixable. Yes, there's hurdles. Yes, there's issues sort of thing. So, but ultimately, what sort of drives it is demand. And what if there is, a clear demand for these cars, which there is, people are going to sort of find solutions. These entrepreneurial sort of fellows will go out and find ways of making it happen sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm my sort of reflections from it is that maybe we are just because we are so used to dealing with perhaps sort of rust being the bigger issue that takes cars off the road, that just because that's now transitioning to something else doesn't mean that there aren't going to be the people there that make it happen. So it's positive. It's nice that that these cars are going to survive now sort of thing. So
Yeah, for me, the thing that's really struck me as well, actually, is as well as there being more specialists being set up and they're bringing sort of their skills and their technology to keep these cars on the road. I think the other thing that's really encouraging is that there's more events giving these cars a platform. So I know the Festival of the Unexceptional, that's now 10 years old. And again, that's done a fantastic job of, again, kind of really shining the spotlight on things like Vauxhall Tigras and, sort of four Pumas and those kind of cars. So we've seen that, but we've also seen more in the way of sort of more coffee meets and evening gatherings and that kind of thing, where actually maybe in the past these cars might have been looked down on a little because they don't have chrome bumpers and carburetors and manual chokes, but actually nowadays people see in the classic car world there's a real nostalgia for them.
We'll say on the preservation of skills side, obviously we're seeing the new skills for modern classics come in, but this was something I found when I was talking to the chap who had done all the machining work for the MG's engine, is there are great machinists out there in sort of people learning the skills and coming through, but they aren't learning the traditional elements of it. They can machine you brand new parts from a billet of steel of aluminium, but when it comes to regrinding something, fitting something to an old traditional style lathe, which is still quite a fundamental piece of kit, they don't know how to do it. They can start you off one on a CNC machine on a brand new sort of milling unit, but to sort of take an existing piece and regrind it on a traditional style lathe or traditional equipment, there is a bit of a shortfall in this sort of this skill set coming in. And it's sort of in this instance, certainly for him, it's causing a bit of a bottleneck because he just can't get the right level of skilled and staff sort of brought in, and while he'd like to be able to teach them how to do it, at the same time he had about 95 job cards on. He had just boxes of motorcycle engines arriving that he hasn't touched, and they've sat in his workshop for 6 months. So there is sort of, it's great we've got these new skills coming through, but I think at the same time it's worth sort of remembering and sort of trying to promote the sort of traditional heritage skills as well.
So do you see a future where we're not reconditioning parts anymore, we're just making everything fresh potentially?
That could be something that we sort of look into. It was something I've sort of come across when I've been buying parts for the MG as well. I can go for either reconditioned comrades, or it's just as easy now to buy completely box fresh brand new pieces that have just been forged. So it's one of those things where it's sort of six of one, half a dozen the other. And I think until someone does sort of a broader survey as to sort of see where these new skills or the heritage skills are coming through, as to which way it's going to go, it also depends on market demand as well, because the cost of having something reconditioned at labor rates, at the simple expense of having that done, can sort of be almost double the cost of simply having a new one made en masse. And I think it's an interesting thing. We talk a lot about things like the Heritage Skills Academy. What they are teaching people is great, but I think it seems the demand for those skills is currently greater than they can supply. They're doing a good job, but there are simply more gaps in the industry for those people than they're able to sort of get through the academy.
But that ties in with something that First Townsend said to me a little while ago when we were looking at the skills gap, and he was saying that there's always been a shortage of artisan workers. So it's not anything new. So there's always been loads of guys out there, you know, beavering away, who are, for want of a better word, bodgers. You know, there's thousands and thousands out there, but trying to find someone who has got a lathe and has got the skill to do it, there's always been a shortage of those guys, but they are still out there. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just a case of finding. There's guys beavering away in under railway arches, and once you found someone, they're your guy. They're your go-to.
Perhaps it's the idea that, you know, the way of communicating with these people has changed, sort of thing. You know, it's because, you know, it was, as you say, just a guy who sort of worked under a railway arch. Everyone knew where he was, sort of thing. We're a bit more global now. We're a bit more dispersed, sort of thing. So we like to sort of have email conversations and things like that. Maybe it is just the way that we need to converse with these people needs to be a little bit more old school as well, sort of thing. So we rely on clubs greatly, don't we, to put us in contact with these people. They're kind of sort of like the mediators, aren't they? So
I mean, I'm very much someone, if I can send an email rather than speak to a human being, I will. But that's come back to bite me a little bit, because there's a chap who I put onto who can rewind my generator for the Beetle, refuses to answer emails. So I've had to pick up the phone and speak to him. You know, and he's like an old boy, doesn't really do tech, but he's like, yeah, get it to me and I'll sort it out. You know, so it's all sort of very sort of loosey goosey, but he is out there, but he's not on the end of an email.
It's interesting, actually. I mean, I found that as well with my MX-5. I've had a couple of things where I've been looking for a particular part for it, and you'll get your, oh, do you know so-and-so on Facebook? And you know, like, okay, well, go and find him on Facebook, leave him a message, hope that he answers it. I mean, I'm much more of the old school, you know, just pick up the dog and bone and chat with them and see, you know, say, or even just pop down to wherever their place is and go and have a look around. But you'll find a lot of the time these days, these people are sort of high, you know, on social media accounts. You've got to hope that they accept your friend request and respond to your message.
Yeah, I find myself struck between sort of the balance of the two. With the Jimny, it's often a case of just plumbing the Facebook sort of pages for people who've got parts and sort of the engineering firms that do those bits, and simply market themselves through the comments section on the Jimny Owners Club on Facebook. But then when it came to getting the MG machined, it was just a case of I happened to know the right guys to go to, in the same way that if I need paintwork done, I just know a guy nearby who does bodywork and paintwork. It's sort of treading in both the new world and the old world, and simply getting the engine machine, I was like, well, this is where we've always taken like bits for the Rileys to go and get machined. It's the guys that my granddad's been using for years, so it's always sort of been, there's the heritage link to it there. So it's just sort of a case of I didn't even need to worry about going on their website, writing them an email and saying this is what I need doing. It was just a case of phone them up, can I drop this off, yeah, we'll take a look at it while we're there, we'll do you the invoice while you stand in the sort of in the workshop, and job done. It was sort of very old school, traditional. And I know, I think there's something to be said, both positives on both sides. I think there's got to be an understanding for people that arrive into the hobby that sometimes you're dealing with old cars. You're going to have to deal with occasionally old tech beyond simply the car itself. And certainly as those skills transition from one generation to the next, I think we're gonna see an interesting bridging as that happens. We say that while we're recording a podcast, which is one of the most like normal forms of media possible. So it's very strangely skewed. Anyway, what was next on the list of topics? That was it. Vintage Stony. Speaking of old cars and old habits, Vintage Stony was of course rescheduled from 1st of January to avoid the horrible weather at the start of the year, and it was instead held on the first Sunday in March, and it had some great success.
Happy New Year. Yeah.
Yes.
yeah, no, I jest, but in all seriousness, I think it's really good to hear that Vintage Stony were able to put that event back. We have seen that this sort of thing happening before. I mean, it's happened quite a bit during particularly the pandemic, as we had a long spell of sort of event organizers going, we might do, we might not, because they just didn't know what the lockdown rules were. But increasingly these days, we are seeing that it's more sort of the weather, the Great British weather, which is putting a halt on events. And I think it was probably the right cause. I remember that storm on sort of going into New Year's Eve. It was absolutely horrendous, and there was a lot of flooding in different parts of the country, so it was absolutely the right call to call it off. But I think it's great to see that they've been able to hold that event, have a really good turnout, and they actually, I think it was more than 7 grand that they raised for charity. So I think that's a really positive thing for them to do. And I know it's haven't been before, it's a great event, so it's just good to see it doing well.
I find it very interesting that they're not sort of tallied up for sure, but they have a suspicion that it attracted a record number of visitors, and yet they still want to commit to going back to that original sort of New Year's Day date. I mean, I think it's a traditional sort of thing, isn't it? Sort of thing, as you just sort of said, Happy New Year. I think a lot of people in that part of the world sort of value that as part of their sort of festive routine, don't they? So.
I think they also have Classic Stony, which they run in June. So they sort of have two events through the year. They want to try and keep them sort of relatively equally spaced, otherwise one treads on the toes of the other. But I mean, I went along to the one in March and it was absolutely heaving. I think it helped that it was the first properly sunny weekend we'd had since the start of the year, by all feels. So everyone was out just enjoying it. And again, it's one of those shows that because it's public access, because it's free to attend and just mill about in, you get that brilliant sort of span of everyone coming out to have a look at these old cars and sort of going, oh, that's quite nice. And yeah, it's sort of a really nice big community feel to it. And again, went along, met some friends there. It's just sort of one of those days where you can properly, you sort of revel in the community aspect of it. So it'll be interesting to see how it feels when it goes back to January. I mean, fingers crossed the weather's good for January 1st, 2026, but it's a long way off yet.
And one of the things with Vintage Stony as well is that it's always particularly quite well represented in terms of pre-war metal. I mean, how did you find the event this year?
It was well stocked with pre-war metal. Again, they always save like the main market square for their pre-war stuff. I think over the years it's seen a shift towards a lot of comparatively modern classics, more 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s stuff were in the sort of surrounding courtyards and the high street. But the market square still has a really strong turnout of vintage stuff from sort of shows opening at 9 all the way through till sort of 10, 11 o'clock-ish, and right up till, I think it finishes about midday, 1 o'clock. So there was a good variety of cars there. And again, it's not just you'd get sort of like 8 or 12 sort of Austin Sevens turn up. We're getting everything from sort of Bentleys, Rileys, all the strange pre-war Elvises and everything sort of rocking up and fills out the space. And again, I think what the show's able to bring, it has a few little display elements here. So we had a racing simulator, we had a local motorsports club with a car on display. So it had a little bit more of a sort of structured show feel to it as well. So it is a show that's grown and sort of made a few changes to keep itself feeling fresh. But yeah, the vintage core to it, still very present and still very appreciated. And you look around it and there are the sort of fantastic, sort of unique vintage cars you expect to see at that show.
Am I right in saying it's free to attend?
Yeah, free to attend. You
So
literally just rock
even
up
more
and go around.
impressive that they've raised, the better part of £7,000 then, isn't it? So that's people, putting their hands in their pockets when they don't need to, so.
Yeah, the volunteers for Vintage Stony doing incredible work, just sort of going around with the donation buckets and sort of the card readers. And I think they take into account, I think because the way it partners with a charity for it, they include in that the sales from the charity shop on the day. So they
Right.
often put the charity shop will sort of essentially put aside all of its motorsports and motoring related ephemera and then puts that on sale for the day so they can sort of tie in with it and give it more of a sort of oomph. And obviously it works. It seems to be, it seems to really work. And again, all the cafes are open on the Sunday morning, so everywhere sort of feels busy. People are milling around with coffees, having breakfast with friends, and it just sort of, I think, really creates that relaxed atmosphere where people are more willing to sort of put their hand in their pocket and go, oh, I haven't really paid to attend this, I'll put some money in the bucket.
I think that's a really important thing, especially with the way sort of, you know, we've seen sort of the climate for sort of, you know, motoring events change over the years. And I know it's for a lot of the more traditional, it can be quite tough out there at the moment, but the thing that's that sort of, I think, really works with events like Vintage Stony and, you know, sort of other events you've seen around the country is that as Chris mentions, it's free to attend. It's obviously, you know, you've got a ready-made audience there straight away. And the other thing is that they're in town and city centres as well, which, so obviously that, with the sort of, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to get people out onto high streets at the moment and you know, boosting local economies, and that's a really good way of doing it. So I think that's a really important thing. I mean, one of the events I went to last weekend was not a car event but a bus event, where they had old buses running around Southport, and they were raising money for charities for the families of the girls affected by that terrible attack that last summer. And again, but it was a great, because they had loads of people who came into where I live in Southport, again coming in and engaging with motoring heritage, and it was free of charge. It just shows that if you bring the metal, people will come.
The public sort of appeal of just a classic car show, I think, is still sort of quite permeating, and I think it still draws out even the most sort of nonchalant people with an interest in them. Like, they'll sort of go along and just sort of look to see just the variety of it. They might not sort of be able to pinpoint the more unique and intricate models, but you'll go along just to sort of enjoy it and see what you spot, and it becomes sort of a very nice family day. And the amount of people that were sort of meeting up, family groups with young children for coffees, breakfast, it was it had this great appeal to it, which is nice to see. Again, the jury's still out on whether or not 1st of January 2026 will have the same pull. Next on the list, though, of course, is our lead story in this week's issue, which is, of course, cars that have entirely become tax exempt across their production run. Chris, this was this an idea of your thinking as well?
Yeah, so every year, David can give you the exact dates, but for a good few years now, we've had rolling tax exemption that also applies to the MOT test as well. You can, when your car turns 40 years old, apply for historic for exemption, and have your car reclassified as a vehicle of historic interest. So that means that every year you see sort of that shift. So in this instance, it's cars built before the 1st of January 1985. So that means that anything that was built in 1984 or before can now apply for that exemption. When we've done this sort of feature in the past, we've looked at those cars that have sort of become tax exempt for the first time. And whilst it's really interesting, it does mean you're working from quite a limited pool, particularly if, you know, you didn't have if it was later on in the year that the production started, sort of thing. It's you know, pretty unlikely that you're going to find one of the first, particularly given that, you know, these cars tend to be the most collectible as well. They have that provenance of being sort of one of the first off the line. So spun it on its head this year, looked at something a bit different. And what we tried to do was find cars are now completely tax exempt. So production ended in 1984, meaning that everything that went beforehand is also tax exempt as well, sort of thing. So threw up some quite interesting cars, sort of thing. So I know that David, you picked the Mercedes-Benz W123 saloons and estates. The two-door CEs continued for a little bit longer, but any sort of big Merc saloon now is tax exempt, regardless of when it was built. So.
Yeah, and the thing I was saying with those cars, sort of the Mercedes, the old Mercedes saloons and estates with those wonderful body coloured hubcaps and bouncy MB Tech seats, is that you know, if you get into a good one, you can still use that every day. They feel like they go on forever. They're wonderfully engineered things, and now you don't have to pay the best part of what, nearly 300 quid for a year in road tax. You can run it around completely free of charge, get on a classic policy. It's good, it's cheap, enjoyable fun.
they are seriously undervalued for what they offer, sort of thing. So I don't know how, but they do feel to me like a bit of an under radar classic sort of thing. So given, you know, their global appeal, I do sometimes wonder about that. So
yeah, they are very much those cards in particular. I think I remember for a long time there were quite a few very shonky survivors that still knocking around because people still use them as daily drivers even today. But nowadays, I mean, the one that I highlighted in this week's issue is being for sale. I mean, that had all the work done to it. It was just over 13k, and that is the price, less than the price of Britain's cheapest brand new car. So you could drive around in a Kia Picanto, or you could have a proper car.
Is the Picanto the cheapest car on sale in the UK, or is that
it depends if you count the Citroen Ami or not as a car.
Quadricycle. I thought the yes. Does Dacia not still have the cheapest one, or have they lost that?
I don't know. They think. I mean, new car news is probably a bit beyond the CGW remit, but I think it's usually Dacia and Kia who regularly spar and trade places for the honour of Britain's cheapest new motor.
Pulling out elements of the car so they can sell it as cheaper and cheaper in some sort of never-ending downward spiral. It's an interesting selection of cars I've actually got in this feature as well. Everything from sort of comfortable big Mercedes saloons to sort of sporting coupes. In fact, there's quite a few sports cars on here. But James, you went a bit sort of against the grain, a practical little hatchback.
Yeah, it kind of ties in with what David was saying about how you could have a cheap, horrible new car, or you could have something interesting. And so I highlighted the Mark 1 Renault 5 because going back 30 years, which makes me feel really old, me and all my mates were driving around in what are now classics, but they were just cheap bangers at that point. And a friend of mine used to have a Renault 5 that was his mum's, you know, and we all laughed at it because it was beige, it had a brown interior, it had a ice slow down for horses stick on the back, all that sort of stuff that you just, you know, you didn't want as a teenager. But it was our first taste of freedom. He was the first one of our group to pass his test. It was his mum's car, but we went all over the place. We went holidays to Wales, went to Wales, went all over the place in it, went to the pub on a Friday night in it if he was designated driver. And it was just, it was a cheap, affordable car. You know, petrol was dirt cheap back in that time. Insurance was cheap, even for a younger driver. And it was just a really cheap way of getting an interesting car that we just went miles and miles in and never even thought about it. And now it's a bona fide classic, which makes me feel quite old.
I mean, it's almost sort of even more sort of double stamped as a classic now they've bought the Renault 5 back in a similar body shape as well, sort of going, or we're sort of revisiting our heritage and sort of what they've gone through is a car that's sort of 40 years old. You sort of go, ouch, okay. But did yours have the little baguette holder inside, or is that just a feature for the modern ones now?
I think we just used to laugh it had a baguette holder. I don't think it ever did. I think we just, like, you know, it was just always just full of junk. It was just a cheap runaround. But actually thinking back about it now, it's exactly the sort of modern classic that I would want to use because it was cheap to run, cheap and easy to work on, no frills, but it was comfortable. You'd go miles and miles in it. I mean, what else do you want in a classic?
I think it probably is worth pointing out that it's the first generation of Renault 5 sort of thing. So obviously, second generation Renault 5 went well past. I'm not going to try and embarrass myself by guessing that date. But yeah, it's the first generation is, because mind you, you tooled around in a second generation one, didn't you, David? So
yeah, I did. I had the Super Sank, as it was called, styled by the same chapter, the Lamborghini Diablo. So a bit of supercar cachet there. And yeah, I had a 1.4 Campus, which I bought for £100 off a mate, and ran around for a year, and I loved it. Again, I know it's underneath, it's a very different car to the Mark 1 Renault 5, but again, I completely agree with James. You know, they are fantastic, fun little cars, and again, they just press all the right nostalgia buttons. Mm.
I've got a friend who's
84 through 96, so quite some time before every second gen becomes a classic.
I've got a friend who's got some quite high-end supercars, and he's also got a Renault 5 Turbo as his classic, and he says he gets as much enjoyment out of that than he does out of his expensive cars, because it's just a completely different animal, and it gets just as much attention when he takes it out.
Mm. I mean, the one that really baffled me was the the TVR, which was became my pick, because I'd sort of looked and lusted after those when they went through an absolute price dip while I was at university. I was sort of in half a mind to bin off the Jimny while I had it and pick up a TVR, because I was like, oh, it's a well-understood drivetrain, and it's sort of not quite, at that point, about sort of 5 6 years ago, it hadn't quite reached its like official classic status. It was sort of in a complete doldrums, and now it's sort of emerging as that sort of last of sort of the wedge style designs from the sort of what had been a hangover of 70s design work. And I'm sort of going, oh no, that is a really tidy piece of design on it. And again, they're still surprisingly affordable for what is quite a muscly little sports car.
It's
So
those
I think,
early Tamars that you're referring to, isn't it? So,
yeah. And just sort of looking at it going, that's quite a tasty option. And 2.8 liters rear wheel drive, you're thinking it's really quite a handful. And again, the design on it is, especially the one that we've used as the lead image for that car, it's a really clean piece of artwork. I'm sort of going, ooh, I can see why that had a bit of appeal in its period. But I mean, that, again, that's another one where we had to stipulate the Series 1, because the Series 2 sort of that wedge iteration ran on for, again, sort of another decade
yeah.
afterwards. Because so they just went, oh, people just about keep buying them, so we'll
We're
keep
focusing on
existing.
those the sort of the brackets of cars. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think the early ones, the Tasmans, they're all tax exempt now, but certainly the later ones, going right up to the 450C Act, they were sort of, I think it was 91, I think it was, that they stopped making those. So again, they've still got a while to go yet. But the great thing is, especially with TVRs, they've such a great enthusiast following that they will be tax exempt, I'm sure, before we know it.
Oh, it will fly by. It was an interesting. Were there any cars that didn't make the cut, Chris? Any cars that either weren't picked or just sort of you didn't feel would be sort of
Yeah, I
familiar
mean,
with the feature?
to sort of give you guys a peek behind the curtain, I created a list and then let the sort of the team choose their favorites from it, sort of thing. So, to be fair, a few people went off the list and found some ones that I didn't find, sort of thing. But a couple of ones that the main two that stand out for me are the Maurice Atal and the Triumph Acclaim. Now, by the mere fact that they're included on this list, it means that now all Maurice badge cars and all Triumph badge cars are now exempt, so they can every single one of those cars that was wears that badge can now be reclassified as a vehicle of historic interest, sort of thing. So, in a nerdy way, I found that quite interesting, sort of thing. So, nobody picked an Austin Ambassador. Shame on you all.
Not even the
And
Y-wedge ones.
and then yeah, there's some interesting sort of, I will call it oddballs, but I mean it in an affectionate way. The likes of like the Matra Rancho. So yeah, I mean there were a couple of Vauxhalls as well. So the Mark I Astra and also the Chevette there on the list as well. And if you've got a particular hankering for a Mark I Jetta, then that's also now qualifies as well. So yeah, it's interesting mix.
I think what a really important thing to point out, obviously, with all these cars that are now fully eligible for tax exemption, is you don't get a letter in the post saying, "Hooray, your car is tax exempt." You actually have you. It doesn't happen automatically. So if you are out there with a car that is now eligible for tax exemption, it doesn't happen automatically. And if you don't get your car tax exempted, you're paying money for road tax when you don't need to.
And within the feature itself, go out and buy it. This issue, there is some in further ins and outs of tax exemption that's just worth bearing in mind. So David highlighted the main one there, but there are some of the bits and pieces to keep in mind as well, which I won't dip into now because I know we're already sort of overrunning on this section, Jesse. So.
No, yeah, we don't want to give away the entire feature for free either, is the other half of that. But yes, it's worth picking up for those sort of tips and tricks. If you are thinking, oh, I'll nip out and buy one if it hasn't been sort of classified yet, we've got sort of a handy little cutout
There you
cube
go.
guide
Available in all good news agents. There you go.
and some bad ones. Yeah, what else have we got to get through on the to-do list? I mean, that's sort of brings us to a sort of a nicely summative point for this week's issue. There's plenty more to enjoy in it. We've got Jamie Garrett's Mini. If you were at the Resto show, you'll have seen the absolutely fabulous Mini that's been in his family for three generations, I think, is the full story. There's also a buying guide for the Triumph TR3, the latest update on the Mini that we're following to Goodwood, Lucy Ellen Rose's Maestro in Next Generation Diaries, and this week The Way We Were heads to Southport. So it's a good little spread we've got in this week's issue, as always. And we're recording this a bit late. We're recording this on Friday. We've still got a lot of work to do to get the next issue ready for press. So gentlemen, thank you for your time this morning. I'll let you all crack on as we're all still very busy, and we'll be back for another edition of the Classic Car Weekly podcast with plenty more to enjoy.
It's been good.
Sounds good. Thank you. Yeah,
absolutely. It should be a good one next week.
Right. Thank you very much. And remember to pick up the latest issue and, of course, subscribe to never miss an issue or edition of the podcast.